Last couple of weeks, we started talking about some qualities that are central in the path. We're sort of rounding out a long summer of looking at some of the foundational teachings in early Buddhism. So we talked about refuge and the precepts, ethical practice. And 2 weeks ago, we talked about the practice or heart quality known as dana or giving. And last week talked about loving kindness or metta. And starting with the two of those, that means we've looked at the first and the ninth of a list of 10 qualities called the paramis, the perfections in the early system. There's multiple lists of 10, and there's a list of 6 paramis or paramitas. So maybe I will now wander my way through that list of 10. It's a nice structure to guide one. And that would mean then that the first of the 10 is dana. And so giving is the foundational heart quality or quality to develop on the path to liberation. These 10 qualities are perfections. Param means the highest, so param, the parami are the supreme qualities. These are the qualities that the Buddha, in his description of his long path over many, many, many eons toward becoming Gotama in his final birth and beginning the system that we know as Buddhism, the Dharma, what he called the teachings and training, or Dhamma Vinaya. When he described his long path toward this final birth, he described it partly in terms of accumulating these 10 qualities, so bringing these qualities to perfection, thus the name, perfections. And in the centuries following his lifetime, especially as the broadening or turnings, sometimes called the second turning of the Dhamma, happened, that became the Mahayana, the great vehicle. These paramis were elevated in stature to be really the center of the path. And this is partly because in the earliest tradition, there was a focus on cultivating the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, cultivating the path toward liberation and becoming what's called an arhant. An arhant is an individual who has seen clearly the nature of things, of themselves and all around them, and has eliminated 10 fetters, things that bind one, that include things like believing in a permanent, unchangeable soul, or the tendency toward grasping, for instance, is one of the fetters, of course. So uprooting these entirely makes one an arhant, one who has experienced their last birth, so no longer reborn as a result of craving, and is fully liberated. And the arhant was thought of as a figure who has the same liberation as the Buddha, so the same amount, as well, of liberation, as if it's an amount. This part is funny, but does something different with it. And over time, there evolved these different types of beings who get liberated. The earliest list has arahants, Pacheka Buddhas, and a Pacheka Buddha is someone who has no teacher, but discovers the path on their own, becomes fully liberated, and does not teach. These are like invisible Buddhas. And the system says that there's actually quite a number of these, but you don't know who they are. And then, so there's arhants who get liberated, Pacheka Buddhas who get liberated but don't teach, and then Samma Sambuddhas, so fully enlightened Buddhas, who are quite rare, but who teach and who establish a, what's called a dispensation or a sasana, a lineage of teaching. And so this was a kind of almost like a tangent in the early texts that got blown up into a new thing in the Mahayana. And what it blew up into was there started to be a distinction between people who were practicing for what goal. And were you practicing with the goal of becoming an arhant, like just to get plain old fully enlightened? Or were you practicing with the goal of becoming a Buddha and establishing a system that would enlighten millions? And then the Mahayana said, well, clearly the better thing to practice toward is to become a Buddha. But to do that, you have to deny yourself the full liberation of the arhant for a very long time. And the way that you do this is by vowing to become a Buddha. And when you do that, you become a new kind of figure called a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is someone who is working on Buddhahood. It takes a very, very long time. But one of the perfections we'll get to in a little while is patience. The bodhisattvas have that quality in spades. And bodhisattva comes from the word, in Pali it's bodhisatta, that Gautama used to describe himself before he got liberated. So he says, back when I was still an unenlightened bodhisatta, I such and such did such and such things. I left home at this age, I practiced in this way. Before this, I spent a period in this particular heaven realm, etc., all the way back through the gazillions of lifetimes. So, what bodhisattvas do, and I'll say bodhisattva because it's the more common version of the word, even though I mostly talk Theravada here, the Mahayana term is more common. In the Paramis, although the list appears in the Theravada, it's more commonly a Mahayana teaching. So, for the next little bit here, which maybe is 10 weeks if I do the whole list, I'll be talking a little bit more from a Mahayana framework, for those of you that care. That's almost nobody, but you know, you know who you are. What bodhisattvas do, rather than try hard to let go or become liberated, what they do is they cultivate the perfections, meaning you focus on these core qualities, and you try to kind of build them up until they are so rooted in your being that you could never do otherwise. So to build up the quality or the impulse, the upwelling of giving, dana, the dana parami, until it is absolutely like the thing you do unwaveringly. And then to build up the parami of sila or ethics by practicing the precepts, as we talked about several weeks ago, going through the five precepts of non-harming, non-stealing, not misusing sexuality, speech, intoxicants. And then the broader sense of sila in the Eightfold Path of wise action, wise speech, wise livelihood, inhabiting our communities in a way that is wholesome, essentially. You bring that, again, to perfection or fruition. And we might ask, like, what does that even mean, to bring a quality to perfection? Because I think often we think of these qualities as practices, right? Ethics is a practice. We have to return to it again and again and again. Every action, there's choices to make. The world is complex. So it's a little hard to think about something as a perfection, meaning it is, you know, unshakably established in us. We might think about it this way. Often when I try to think about what attainment is in these systems and what it could mean to be fully finished with something. I try not to go sort of cosmic or magical and be like, oh, you know, your sense of self like completely disappears and you exist in a void space of infinite equanimity. Like, maybe, but that's almost too fantasy-like for my taste. And many of you have heard me talk like this before, I often think about developmental psychology and the way that there are qualities that are appropriate at a certain phase of development, like coming through childhood and young adulthood, that if you achieve that phase of development, you essentially never lose it, barring like utter calamity in the mind, heart, or something. So, you know, some of the simple ones, they're only simple after you've mastered them. There's one that my baby is doing right now called object permanence. And the game at the moment is little shaker egg, which makes a nice rattling sound. So I've given him my shakers from my old percussion days. And the little bowl, the bell that I ring for meditation. So he's got a little bell, and he's got a shaker. It's nice that they're both musical. But the current game we discovered a little while ago is put the shaker egg down, take the bell, and cover it. And so where'd it go? Right? And to see him go, I got this. There it is. And then he looks around and he goes, it's gone. Right? And he covers it up again. And then there it is. It's there again. And you know that something's happening because this is interesting. Right? He's laughing. He's like, uh-huh. At a certain, then he picks up the egg, puts it in the bell, and then dumps it out, and then covers it again. And the whole thing is like, something's happening here about what appears and disappears and that you have agency with it. When it disappears, it's not gone. He knows where it is. So, you know, in a very simple kind of neurological way, that's a stage, right? There's completely a moment earlier, we did this one, where that's not the case, you know, where he's like totally playing with something, but he shouldn't really be playing with it, whatever it is, and you're like, hey, look over there. And he goes, eh, and you take it away, and he doesn't notice, right? He just kind of keeps going with whatever's there, right? Oh, something disappeared, and it's just gone, right? So this kind of thing, it's like, yes, you had to learn it. You've all learned it, presumably. But you wouldn't be functional adults if you hadn't. You wouldn't be adults at all. You've all learned it, and you've forgotten what it was like to not know it, and it will never leave you, essentially, right? And this brings out actually very interesting questions about things like dementia, right? Which we could go into later. Like, what happens if a Buddha gets dementia? Could they? What happens when their sense of self goes, if it already went? So I have no idea what the answer to this question is. But we have examples of very, very, very enlightened people who have aged and have lost some mental faculty. And it's very interesting. It's very interesting. But I'm going to go on. That's a tangent. It's an interesting one. So I interpret perfection in the sense of these things as if, what if it's the case that something like ethical action or generosity or tonight's perfection, renunciation, it's a very unpopular word in Western Buddhism. What if these things are like developmental stages, that at a certain point they can be so implanted in our being that they're unshakable? And that we don't really have to work at maintaining them. They're just there, right? One of the paramis is loving kindness, is metta. What's it like when, and I imagine we've each had periods in our life that are like this, and aspects of this that are here already. What's it like when a certain a certain tone of basic kindness has become so much a part of your being that you could not not do it, right? Are there things like, aspects of like just being mean that maybe as a child you had a phase of really just being mean for a little while? Most kids do at some point, right? You figure out that you can do it and you can like really affect people by being mean, and for a little while some kids, they really go for it. And now, like, oh, you just wouldn't do that. So some aspect of like the perfection of loving kindness has come to maturity. And so what if that could go all the way? Is the proposition in the word perfection, the perfections. So the first three perfections in the sequence are dana, giving, sila, ethical action, and nekama, renunciation. So renunciation. It's a very difficult instruction for so many of us. It suggests that as a foundation in practice, the attitude of letting go of that which we don't need, first of all, is central. But then also it goes deeper. When the Buddha described famously the ailment we suffer from and the cure, he said in the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, which is grasping, there's an end to that grasping, and there's a way to get to that end. And the end to grasping is the end of suffering, right? If there's a symptom and a cause, you want to end the symptom, you end the cause. So grasping is identified, Second Noble Truth, as the core of the issue of suffering. And then long explanation of what grasping means. So renunciation is the opposite of grasping. It's its quality opposite. If grasping or holding on or reaching in a craving kind of way for things, experiences, people, situations, is the cause of our suffering, renunciation is the letting go of that activity. And in the commentaries on renunciation, it says that renunciation arises naturally when one realizes, so this is an insight in a way, that craving will never work to attain happiness, no matter what the craving is for. So whether it's for pleasant things or to get rid of unpleasant things, or even the craving for spiritual things or wholesome things, that eventually the craving itself has to be let go of or renounced. So a simple way to say that in terms of spiritual progress is the only way to make spiritual progress is to let go of wanting to make spiritual progress. But, and this is very interesting, we'll get there in a couple of weeks, determination, strong determination, is also a perfection. And the Buddha was famous for striving hard in his practice. So it sets up a beautiful paradox, actually, that passionate engagement with practice and really going for it and knowing what you're going for. Like he says in the texts, don't try for a lesser goal. Don't set your sights on a middle-ish goal. You know, like, and I've been making fun of Dan Harris all year. I shouldn't. He's a perfectly good guy. But he discovered mindfulness, and then he wrote the book 10% Happier. Like, and the implication is this is a good thing to go for, which it is, you know. But the Pali texts say don't go for halfway, 10%. Really, 10%, man. At least 30? I don't know. But he was humble, which is good. It's actually a very realistic goal. But the Buddha says don't go for the realistic goal. Go for the full thing. So how do we square that with renunciation? Renunciation, we can think of in a couple of ways. We can think of it materially, like live simply. We can think of it emotionally, like cultivate the quality of letting go as a energetic quality or an emotional quality. We can think of it in relation to the wisdom teachings of really let go in a profound way of the things that bind us. And that's going to be things like the belief in permanence, the belief in an abiding personal essence, the various things that we cling to on a very subtle level that are mostly not conscious, right? The sense of time and space as linear and contiguous, that degree of clinging, right? At some point, we have to soften our grip on. So all of these, in a way, are challenging. Renunciation in the material realm is often sort of the first one that gets focused on. And traditionally, this was for monastics to not own anything at all, to have, you know, three robes, bowl, toothbrush, umbrella, that's about it, sandals. And for lay people to cultivate giving, renunciation and giving go hand in hand. If you want to give a lot, you have to be able to let go of your stuff. So you give a lot of resources to support those in need. This is a challenging teaching around here, let's say for a few reasons. One, we live in a very, very privileged, wealthy area. So there's a lot of stuff around that you can have. I think for a lot of folks drawn to the Dharma, maybe a lot of us, we fall somewhere in the range of like very wealthy to not wealthy at all. For lots of folks in the Bay Area, it's such a stretch to live here that to say, let go further in the material is a little absurd. And especially for the poor, what are we asking them to let go of? What is renunciation for someone who's struggling to pay the rent to buy food? And I think that's really important because we have to square it being a fundamental teaching with the reality of economic precarity. Right? Things are actually economically bad for most people, statistically. So what does renunciation mean there? Renunciation as a practice can only develop when it's taken on willingly, right? So having to go hungry because you can't afford food is not fasting, right? Fasting is entering a period of practice where you willingly cut back. So as we've often come to in these discussions, I lament the absence in our culture of ways to live that are profoundly simple. There's not a lot of options for those who want to choose radical simplicity. One of the Buddhist teachers I like a lot and a translator from the classical Chinese named Bill Porter, or his Chinese monastic name is Red Pine, and he's done some of the best, most beautiful translations of the early Mahayana texts. He's my favorite translator by far of the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, the Sutra of Huineng. And he, like a lot of these old guys, he was in the Vietnam War, and then he was a translator for the radio service in Taiwan. And then he just sort of moved into a Taiwanese monastery and kind of hung out with the monks and traveled around China meeting old hermits and basically had, you know, a sort of hippie Dharma life. He's this old guy now with a big white beard. And in the acknowledgments page on several of his books, where he's thanking his teachers and his family, etc., he says, I want to thank the Department of Children and Families in the state of Washington for their food stamp program and for general assistance, which has enabled me to live simply and write these books. So don't tell the right wing that GA is being used by, you know, a Buddhist sage to, you know, who could probably get a job if he really tried, you know. But in a way, it's beautiful, and he's practicing a kind of voluntary poverty. So the complexity of a system where there's no monastic option, you can't go and become a monk or a nun and live in voluntary poverty. You can, if you want to, let me know. I'll tell you where to go. But there's not that many options. So renunciation is different for us in a material sense than maybe it was in the time of the Buddha, where it could mean a very clear thing. But materially, there's still so much that we can do. And for those of us who are not in the realm of poverty, the realms of poverty, what can you do to simplify? A beautiful list came out this week, a writing by one of my favorite writers, Rebecca Solnit, and it was a list of 10 guidelines for writers, how to write. The first one is write. The second one is listen, meaning listen to people. But it goes with the corollary, don't listen too much, as in don't listen to what they think of your writing. One of them is time, and she says time is scarce, you have to make it. And one of her guidelines for that is live below your means. Make a lot of time for writing. She says she knows a young painter who complains about not having enough time for painting, works as a server in a restaurant. But Rebecca says, but the young painter is wrong. Somewhere along the way, she transitioned from someone who lives on burritos to someone who orders the better wine at the bistro. So her problem is taste, not time. If she changed her tastes, she'd have an extra day for art. So there is something we can all look at our habits and say, you know, I mean, and I do it, you know, every time I'm in gorgeous Pizzaiolo, my local office, where I buy a $4 coffee and a $4 scone, and mostly pretend to write. Every once in a while, I really try to think, like, do I need to do this? You know, if I added this up, like, you know, could I have 10 extra days of writing retreat a year? You know. But you choose your thing, right? At one point, I was like, I don't buy new clothes. Partly because the politics of new clothes, I couldn't figure out how to square it with the previous perfection of ethics. But in addition, I can buy this very nice, groovy teaching shirt, you know, at Goodwill or Crossroads for $10 instead of $70 at the store. So that's worth it to me. So I, you know, you make your choices somewhere. The material. Of course, if we all stop being consumers, the economy will crumble. And this is a beautiful, interesting paradox for those of us who think that, you know, changing our personal habits will change the society. An article came out in a journal internal to the advertising industry in London in the mid-90s. And it said, there's a group of young people that's out there now. It's my young people. I was really proud of this article. There's a group of young people out there right now that that we can call the non-participants. They believe in simplicity. They believe in authentic human relationship. They actually believe that shopping is bad. And this is really a problem. Because these people are there's a lot of them. And if they are really allowed to generate cultural force, that's going to be really bad for sales for decades. And I appreciated how the advertisers recognized this. You know, in the same way that the, you know, even though the the sort of the Fox News wing of the Republican Party is happy to deny climate change, but the insurance industry, which is not known for being liberal, has been very quietly adding up the insurance risks for a long time now, and just not really publicizing it, you know, but absolutely not denying it one bit, saying, oh, this is going to happen, intense storms are going to happen, sea level change is going to happen, and they're just quietly changing the data, you know, to favor themselves over the years. So you know, trust the money for doing the real data research. So the advertisers knew that if we actually renounce in the material realm, it really hurts them. And that's a mystery that I don't have a great answer for in terms of, like, I would love to just say, hey, everybody, stop shopping. There, I said it. Hey, everybody, stop shopping. Right? And in a way, you can trust that, like, most people won't, so it's fine. But you can. You can. So the material is a practice that affects ourselves and others. It sets up a framework for the wisdom and heart practices. And I think it's a powerful practice to find something in your life materially to let go of, to stop churning in or grasping toward. Letting go in the heart quality. How do we let go in relation to, like, people, relationships, the way that we cling to having things be the way we want them to be? Right? Such and such person is challenging for me, this relationship is challenging, things are not going the way I want at home or work. And the feeling of grasping is this contraction where we, it's almost like from the wide open field of everything being just the way it is, something threatens our comfort emotionally. And it's like the wagons circle around, like, no, I can't let that happen. And we narrow our scope to be like, no, it must be this way. So what would renunciation be in those cases? Right? Letting go of trying to make things be the way I want them to be. That's one way it's talked about. This gets very interesting and delicate when we think about how we make decisions at all. How do you choose what to do next if you're really letting go of trying to make things be the way you want them to be? And we can look at the list of the paramis and say, oh, renunciation rides on the foundation of sila or ethics. One of the things you do is you fall back on your ethical framework and you say, if it wasn't about how I want things to be, but I was just trying to not harm, not steal, not cause distress, what would I do? And in a sense, you can use the ethical framework as a crutch, you know. And it works that way, right? That's what it will help you make the decision when you're not sure. One of my teachers says, I never let go of anything. Pause. You know, Buddhist teacher saying to a shocked crowd of students, I never let go of anything. And then he would go on to explain that letting go is not a volitional action. It's not something that you consciously do. But it happens on its own. You know, I never decided to be done with anime, with an obsession with Japanese cartoons as a teenager. I thought that it would be with me for a very long time. I had posters on my wall, you know. And you know, I never decided that there was a day, like there was one final day when transformable robots and little girls with huge eyes in short skirts was suddenly not interesting to me as a genre of entertainment. But it happened. And it never reappeared as interesting. So how does letting go happen? Right? When a relationship changes, or a job changes, or our family situation changes, when we just find ourselves like leaving one place and being in another place, how does it actually happen? We think we made a choice, but something's been moving for a long time that unfolded in that choice, and something is let go of. So I think true renunciation emotionally is also a developmental stage. It's something that happens when conditions are ripe. We can't force it. Renunciation in the classical text is often associated with like the big renunciation in monasticism called celibacy. And there's basically two ways to be celibate. One is to decide that you should be and try really hard. And that way has a lot of suffering in it. The monastics are like, struggling, right? I want. I shouldn't have. And the other way is to realize that you're done. That you're already done. And that's the way that's more wholesome, I think. So maybe it's like that with many kinds of letting go. Not like, oh, I should let go of this thing because I should. But some part of us can tune in honestly to the part of ourselves that goes, oh, it's already gone. And then all I have to do is admit it and be like, oh, that's done. So maybe I'll pause there because we started a little late. We had fun social time, all sorts of, who knows. I told too many jokes in between. But it's a good place to stop this turning, where we think a thing is a practice to be developed willfully, but it turns out that it's describing something that is almost like a maturing that happens on its own. Puberty appears on its own. Childhood disappears. Yeah. There's no stopping it, actually. Adulthood creeps up on you. And by the time you realize that it's there, it's actually been there for a long time. So let's take a moment to settle. Thank you for listening warmly. And some time for your thoughts. And I'd love to just hear your reflections. Yeah, for sure. The difference would be, are they stopping intentionally, or are they stopping because they can't continue, right? Because, again, poverty is the hinge.
Yeah.
If people are not buying expensive things because they can't, even though they want to, right, that wouldn't be renunciation, right? The real change would be if, again, like so many of these, it's we're talking about values, right? The real change would be when the values in the culture change. You know, if there's suddenly a wave of animal rights compassion, and not just some like fringe hippies on the coasts, but like millions and millions of people became vegetarian, like so many that you'd find like, you know, your aunt in Kentucky and vast stretches of the heartland saying, we don't want to do this anymore. Like, that would change things, right? For it to be renunciation, though, it has to be, you know, a heart, it's a heart quality. You know? But indeed, may those hurt by the retail slump continue to survive and find their way, of course. Natalia.
I have a question. Thank you, Sean, for the beautiful lecture. What is your reflection on the difference between when you're forcefully kind of declining lucid things, or when you stop it willfully? Because in my experience, I had to stop doing certain things forcefully, and I didn't want to let it go.
Uh-huh.
However, it taught me a lesson after a while, and after experiencing other conditions, I decided to stop or let go of things willfully.
Yeah.
So I got exposure, but initial exposure to different conditions,
yes,
was not my choice.
Yes.
I'd say so. Now I realize it was a good thing, but in the beginning, I was not ready to let go. And
sure.
If it was not for the forceful...
And like forceful from someone else, right? Like.
Yeah, like I had to do, for example, with fasting.
Yeah.
So I do have experience with fasting, and I didn't want to do it, but I knew it's going to be so good for me.
Uh-huh.
And it did, so I'm kind
of... Yes.
Not
yeah.
Ready for new experiences, but yeah, it was tremendous help.
Yeah.
Certain conditions that they had.
I think it's an important distinction, right? Because initially, if you're being forced to let go of something, you know, let's say, like, I don't know, my family does an intervention and they put me in, you know, heroin rehab, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to go, yada yada, right? They tried to make me go to rehab, and I said, no, no, no. So that's not renunciation, right? That's being forced to, you know, do the thing. But once I experience, or like as you're saying, once you experienced something new, and you connected that new feeling with the new conditions, like you made me let go of this thing, and then, oh, look, it feels right. Now I will do it on my own, intentionally. That second part is the renunciation part. Right? Once you're choosing it and you're able to let go into it, like, oh, this just feels right. And you don't have to force yourself as much because you've felt the goodness of doing it a new way. That's the part that I would call renunciation. The previous part you could call discipline, right, which is something else. Yeah, and they weave together. Like, sometimes, because it's not linear, some days I use my discipline to not eat too much sugar, and some days I really don't want it, which is true renunciation. And you know, that just depends. Like, if I'm having a depressed or anxious day, I have to use force on myself, and other times it's just not there. And that, to me, is just evidence that my, you know, that particular renunciation has not achieved perfection yet, right? I'm still engaged in a kind of gentle battle with it, you know. And to the extent that more and more there's a certain thing that I simply don't want, that's actually the definition of renunciation, right? The opposite of craving. You just don't want it. So you don't have to resist the hand-filled naughty cream donuts at the bourgeois donut place on 49th Street and Telegraph. It is not possible. It cannot be resisted. Resistance is futile. But it's true that if you have to struggle to resist it, that's different, right, than appreciating its existence but not being drawn. So that's the shift. And again, you can't force yourself to make that shift. You can force yourself to discipline yourself to not do it. You know, you can walk by like, you know, Ulysses lashed to the mast, like smelling it, but just being like, I will hold my ground against the sirens. But But the true renunciate practice actually is for Ulysses not to lash himself, but just to ride past and hear the song and let it wash through him without any need to jump overboard. Right. Does everyone know the myth I'm referring to? Does anyone not know the myth I'm referring to? One doesn't want to make classical allusions as a kind of in-joke. Good. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
When you were talking about material renunciation and why it's difficult to achieve in our culture, and especially, like you were saying, for the poor, I had like two thoughts about that. One of the things that I think is like really difficult is that material renunciation and cultivating these virtues actually has a high price to it in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like going to retreats and, you know.
Truly.
For the most part. There are some places where it's available for free, but the Dana base, but yeah, that's definitely a struggle, I think, for a lot of people. But then also I was thinking about when you were talking about people in poverty and what renunciation would mean for them, kind of on the energetic, emotional level, I think there's also kind of this sense of them needing and striving for justice.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel that justice can be like squashed also with this idea of renunciation.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, a lot of times we tell ourselves, oh, we don't have it as bad as people in this part of the world.
Sure.
Or, you know, these, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I've just been thinking.
For sure. I think this is important, you know. If renunciation is a letting go of something that doesn't serve us, we have to identify what it is that doesn't serve us in order to let it go. So, let's say, you know, someone who's part of an oppressed class if you don't have it to let go of, it's also not renunciation. You know, it's not renunciation to say, oh, person of an oppressed class, you should let go of even more power or agency or, you know, material resource.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear folks like, this famous quote from Mandela upon leaving the prison, saying, you know, I had to leave behind my bitterness and resentment and anger, because if I took them with me out into the world, they would have won, essentially. So you find a kind of strength, I think, in the folks who struggle that seems to have this quality of, like, what is it that needs to be let go of? You know, a certain, a sense of oneself as weak, perhaps. You know, lots of things, right? Isolation. So maybe the easiest thing that I would say about it is that I wouldn't teach it as a quality that needs to be developed in the context of you know, some folks' lives. Right, I would teach other things, right? Strength, power, right? Clarity, and just trust that it's in there. Trust that it's part of the path that that eventually will arise if it needs to. If it needs to, you know, I would trust that it's on this list partly because this is an ancient monastic system, and when folks from oppressed groups practice deeply, so many conditions are at play there. You know, they have to find some degree of safety and healing and all of the things that support practice. And all of us do in relation to whatever way we've been wounded, find those things. So it's almost like whatever we have to heal has to be healed before whatever is before, I don't know if it's linear, but in addition to whatever is excess being let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And those things maybe happen even at the same time. But I'm glad you say it. It's a good reflection, right? Like, what is this teaching? How do we apply it in a way that's sound and with justice? Yeah.
I like how you link it with the craving, because then it's really in the moment and it's immediate. If it's the flip side, then it's not in the abstract so much and say, what if in this type of situation? Well, no. It's when you encounter that craving, then when you're free of it, that's the renunciation. But if you're denying it and you're still feeling the craving, you still have the suffering. But if you really are letting go of it, then the suffering's gone and that's renunciation.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what's it like to work hard for justice, but to at the same time let go of getting what you want in each moment? Right? You see this in folks who recognize that this line about the arc of justice being long, you know, the arc of history being long. What's it like? What would it be like? What's it like to work for something your whole life that you won't ever actually realize in this lifetime? Right? And then we can go back to the stories of bodhisattvas developing something over countless eons. Right? Like we know that true restorative, beautiful, let's say racial justice is not going to appear in our lifetimes in this country. Like, God willing, it'll get better and better and better. But, you know, you don't heal 500 to 1,000 years worth of torment in 100. You heal it in 500 to 1,000 years, probably. Like, I don't even know how long that takes. So what do? Right? You just keep working toward it. That's the bodhisattva thing. That's why patience, which we'll get to, is in there. You know? And you let go of, like, getting what you want, because it's just not going to happen immediately. Anything else? Andy, please.
And you could kind of just book it like this, but I was really curious about actually your tangent
Punt.
About teachers who lose their mental faculty.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. So here's a little story. This is a story. A teacher just died quite recently who was the senior Western Vipassana teacher, senior Western lay Vipassana teacher. Her name was Ruth Dennison. She was a student of Sayagyi Ubakhin in Burma, who was the teacher of Goenka. So, long time, very classic Vipassana teacher. And she's also a student of Margaret Sanger, who developed sensory awareness practice in the mid-20th century. And she, after much study and practice, came back to the States to found a center down outside of Joshua Tree in the desert, deep in the desert, called Dhammadana, named after one of the early women followers of the Buddha. She was an amazing teacher, and she would teach in this kind of very, very unique way. She talked all the time through all the meditations. She would sort of harangue you to come into your senses and just like try to guide people. And if it wasn't working, she'd take everyone running out to the top of a hill in the desert to jump up and down and like dance and move their bodies. She was a gem of a teacher. Near the end of her life, she both had some health issues herself, and she cared for her husband for a long time through a long declining illness, which was really exhausting for her, as it often is being that kind of caretaker. And she started to waver in a way, kind of mentally, at the end of her life. And there's a story my teacher Jack tells of being in a hall with her, many hundreds of people, to hear her speak. She's giving a Dharma talk. And she starts telling about her husband's illness and how difficult it's been. And then she pauses and kind of looks around. And then she starts telling the same story again, just kind of from the beginning. And she tells the whole story as if she hadn't told it before. And the whole is kind of fidgeting. And then she kind of pauses and looks around. And then she starts telling the same story a third time. And in the middle of that third time or something like that, some people get up and start to walk out. It's been a long talk. It's late. And someone's walking out. And she says, "Wait. Come back. Of course, leave if you want. But what you are seeing is a senior teacher failing. It's a rare thing to see." So she knows what's happening, but she couldn't stop it happening. And it's amazing to sense like what it would be, what it's like to see someone who's both losing a certain capacity, but whose witness mind, whose clarity is absolutely there. And it suggests to us, of course, and so many of these teachings suggest to us that the thing we call the self and the mind that functions in a certain way is not actually myself. It's a thing that functions based on conditions. And that it can actually be witnessed from a place of not identification. That she could actually say, "You are seeing something happen that is quite rare." You know, to say, "I too can see it happening." And implied in that is I think an aspect of like, and I'm not that, right? Like that's the teaching on selflessness, right? The body is not myself. Neither is this Dharma talk coming from myself. It's coming from conditions, and when those conditions change, what happens can also change. When my teacher, Jack's teacher, Ajahn Chah, was aging, he suffered a stroke, possibly. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but that left much of his body paralyzed, and he couldn't speak. And he was kind of in this mute, still body for 10 years, plus a little bit. And the monks just took care of his body. But he... you know, he couldn't interact, really. And what's it like to be with a teacher who was so clear and so sharp, who is then kind of gone in a certain way? At least he can't express anything. And they didn't know what the state of his mind was, because he couldn't express it at all. They were just taking care of this old man's body in a hut in Thailand. One story says, you know, at some point, two of the monks that were taking care of him started kind of arguing about something, kind of in his presence, because he's kind of an empty presence at this point, right? He's just this body. It's been years. Some of them have never even knew him in his active phase. They start arguing about something petty, and they hear him suddenly go into this like wild sort of coughing, and he's like retching and coughing, and he hocks up this huge loogie, and it spits across the room and sticks to the wall between them. And he collapses back on the bed. And, you know, you're just like, whoa. Right. There's not that many examples, but that's two that I know of life. But it's a very interesting question. And as my teacher's generation now ages, it's a question that's being thought about. We should stop. It's late. Pleasure to be here. I will be absent the next 2 weeks. There will be good subs. They're not quite completely confirmed yet, so I won't tell you who they are. But they're awesome, because of course they are. And they will talk about something for 2 weeks. I'll be on the East Coast with my boy. please do come and continue your own practice with them, support their teaching practice. I know it's tempting to do the thing of like oh, the teacher I'm used to isn't there, so I'm not going to go, but do come. And I will be back the 6th of October, I believe. I will actually come and teach you all the evening of the day, of the morning where I do my PhD defense.
Oh.
So either I will be Dr. Sean when I see you next, or something will have gone terribly wrong. And that's fine. But not really. So I'll tell you how much craving I have to this thing being done once it's done. We're, as always, on the beautiful and challenging practice of the gift economy, your generosity with your resources, your letting go of some resources to support the group is profoundly necessary in order for this kind of thing to happen, and is a gesture against the machine. So thank you for your generosity. Anything you leave gets split in half between the studio and myself, and you can leave it in the little basket up there. Blessings the next couple of weeks. I'll miss you. That's honest. This is like one of the sweetest things I get to do in the week, which perhaps speaks to the amount of ecstatic pleasure in my life. But I do like you very much, and it's a joy to come. So take good care. Yeah, thank you so much.
And
Oh, come Sunday.
Yeah.
Totally. Come and meet the baby.